Welcome to episode 49 of the Mountainland Running Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Heiderscheidt from the University of Wisconsin Sports Medicine. And here with my co-host, Mountainland Physical Therapist Extraordinaire, Jeremy. I don't have to say your last name anymore. It's just going to be a first name introduction from here on out.
Well, that's why I prefer, you know, I remember in high school, it was always the last name, wasn't it? Stoker, get over here.
Yeah, right.
So Jeremy is good. No bad memories with that. So,
although if it's your first name that's only being yelled, that's usually your mother and you've done something wrong.
Don't you combine it? Jeremy Stoker, get you over here, you know.
That's right. It's all one word.
Yeah.
One name combined. That's right. Good to have you back. Let's get rolling.
Yeah.
All right. So as a reminder to our listeners, the 2020 Mountainland Running Summit is on and it is online. So make sure you check out our webpage at summit.mlrehab.com. It is a live event, October 2nd and 3rd. And again, the speakers are phenomenal this year. We've got a couple returners, Dr. Krabeck from University of Washington, myself, I'll be there, and several new speakers as well, including Allison Gruburn, we've got Dan Kobian, and we've got Daniel Frey. So we've got some fantastic individuals that will be speaking on a variety of topics. Please check out our website to see what's there. The format, of course, will be a little bit different because it is online, so you can register and listen live, or there's, of course, the option of registering and listen to the recordings afterwards if it's better for your schedule. So check out the website and learn all the details. Send questions and feedback to podcast@mlrehab.com. As always, we like to hear what you have to say and utilize that to invite different guests onto our show. Well, today we have a returning guest, Jeff Burns, Dr. Burns from the University of Michigan. Many of you may have heard his earlier podcast with respect to some of his work on step rate characteristics and running injuries and using wearables to monitor them over the course of an ultra endurance run. Well, we've invited Jeff back because he's got some pretty cool other information to share with us with respect to footwear and shoe design and some regulations in that area. Obviously a big area of interest. So again, just a reminder on his background, Dr. Burns is a runner and sports science researcher, recently completing his PhD from Michigan School of Kinesiology. His research involved the development application of methods to compare runners to simple biomechanical systems. His studies have explored mechanical patterns in high-performing individuals ranging from sub-4-minute milers to ultra-marathoners. Jeff received his bachelor's and master's degree in biomedical engineering and has worked professionally as an engineer in the automotive, medical device, and orthopedic research fields. Additionally, he competes internationally as an ultra-marathoner. He's a national champion in the 100K and has represented the United States at world championships in the 50 and 100K distances, where he has finished as high as 5th on 2 occasions. Welcome back, Jeff. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. It was a lot of fun last time and looking forward to continuing our chat on more running-related shenanigans again.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're glad we didn't scare you away the last time. I mean, Jeremy has a vicious bite.
And so yeah.
Most guests don't come back a second time.
Right. Yeah. But I think it's pretty cool that you – I just think about the last one and the participation in your own study, right? I mean, you're one of the subjects. I don't think that's often a normal thing. So that's pretty cool.
No, and actually, and I think one of the things that maybe allowed me to do that with no any sort of bias on the study or anything is that because it was conducted post hoc, I had no idea at the time that I was going to be a participant in my own study. So yeah, it was cool to look back on it with an objective lens, but yeah.
Yeah.
So just as a reminder for our listeners, if you want to check out Jeff's prior podcast, it's podcast number 46, in May of 2020 on the download site. So take a look and you can hear all about it on step rate predictors during competition. All right, Jeff. So we got you back on because we're going to talk about shoes and footwear and what is going on in that area. Cause I know one, you've got a background in this area. So hopefully you can revive or share that with our listeners, maybe give them a sense of what your history is in the footwear realm. But then also we'll head into a cool editorial that you recently published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. So maybe a little bit about on your background in footwear first.
Cool. Yeah. So, I kind of mentioned in the last podcast, my background and kind of extended lead up to why I'm studying running now as a researcher, one of the most formative things was, I grew up, I would say largely, my earliest memories are of my dad running, and he was, him getting all sorts of shoes. Yeah, I mean, I go home and he has 15 pairs of running shoes of every different kind. So he's a huge geek on that side. The place that I grew up hanging out was the running shoe store in town. I'm from Northern Michigan. We have actually two running stores called Running Fit, and it's a Michigan, there are a couple of them in Michigan, but it's your quintessential local running shop. But he was buddies with not just all the people who work there, but the managers there. And so it's very much, I look back as like, think of the like 90s sitcom Friends, and they're all like hanging out at the coffee shop all day. That was like growing up, we'd go into town and we'd go hang out at the running shoe store for a little bit. And I loved it. I'm sure it annoyed the heck out of my mom and my sisters. But anyways, grew up around that. I remember when I first started running, middle school, and started running cross country and track. One of my first days, like, I think I was maybe 11 years old, 11 or 12, had a pair of 2004 Pegasus. It was earlier than that. It could have been 2004s. Anyways, one of the early pairs of Pegasus. And just thinking, like, what is Nike Air? Like, we know what it looks like on the outside of the shoes with the exposed bubbles. But in this shoe that says it has full length Nike Air, but I can't see it, it's in the foam, what does that look like? So, taking a knife from our kitchen, probably to my mom's dismay, and cutting up my shoe and hacking it apart and seeing, and I was actually like quite let down. I was thinking there was going to be this nice long, like cool air bubble, but it was very much this, like, it almost looked like just a sponge with like kind of compressed things to hold in. It was really not that much air. But anyways,
how old were the shoes?
They were done.
I hope so.
They were probably like, 5 or 6 months old. Cause I the rate that I go through shoes now, running, 120 plus miles a week regularly, is quite a bit different than the rate of shoes I went through as a fifth grader or sixth grader. they were, they had seen the better part of my, fifth or sixth grade cross country season. I have always just been fascinated with the mechanics of shoes. My first job, as soon as I was old enough to work, was working at that running shoe store. And I continued to do that throughout college. So I worked there through summers for 6 years. And then even throughout college, even when I had other jobs, I'd go in and pick up shifts on and off. And I still like to just walk into running stores and hang out and watch people buy shoes and try them on. I don't know. So anyways, formative years have been very much kind of in that realm. Cause as runners, like, shoes, so funny in this center, this is the crux of the shoe debate. As runners, like, we have no equipment. And that's the beauty of running, is it's just human performance. But that one thing that we have, and you could make arguments of like your clothes and your shorts. I'm very particular about my shorts. The shoes are the one thing, relative to every single other sport that has a significant piece of equipment involved, shoes have a small effect, but because it's the only effect, it's very pronounced and noticeable for runners. And so it's that one thing that we have to, it's our interface with the ground. So that's kind of, like I said, I've grown up with, working in the running shoe store. And it's funny thinking back now of like, I'm sure a lot more people are familiar with, I would say, the colloquial biomechanics of running shoes as opposed to the actual body of scientific literature on running shoes. And that is, this is how I learned it growing up working in the store, and probably how most people do, is like, there are three types of running shoes. There's the neutral shoe, the stability shoe, the motion control shoe. You fit into one of these three categories. Every company makes their version of these three shoes. In each of those, there are several different types of cushioning, which in, and so it's like, mm-hmm. And I, it's so funny thinking like that is the framework with in which I lived and like understood all feet and shoes to operate in. And then only once, you know, you actually start picking apart the literature and really you start understanding biomechanics on more fundamental side, it's just like that it's, that is so different than like how the human body actually works. But I think it actually speaks more broadly to the like flexibility and plasticity of the human body interfacing with shoes is like, we can come up with this really appealing schema and framework to classify mm-hmm. shoes. And then we can just fit people into it because they're relatively adaptable and like broadly works, and it works to sell shoes and it works to put people in there. And it's like, it's an easy thing to, I mean, cause I think probably one of the most important things now that I look back at selling shoes to people, like the most important thing, and this speaks more broadly to sales in general, is like making somebody feel comfortable with their purchase. So if you can tell them like, yeah, yes, I saw you walking and your foot pronated, so therefore you should be in this stability shoe, and they're like, ah, my mind is at ease, I should be in this shoe. So anyways,
yeah, that's exactly back, right. You know, like, you get into those algorithms and how they perpetuated themselves and have completely taken a root and are not going anywhere unseemingly, no matter what the science says regarding it.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, there's an entire journal, you know, foot journal or footwear science mm-hmm. that's devoted very largely to running footwear. Yeah. And you're right. You see a tremendous amount of really cool, it's good work that's done mm-hmm. on the materials, the composition, the design. Features, the modeling work, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what you're hitting on is I, you know, once I started studying engineering in school, and especially, you know, I would say the formative class that I took was early on, maybe my sophomore years, or material science class, where you mm-hmm. just learn, you know, the broad overview of, you know, mechanical properties. And of course, this is taken in the context of like, you know, with mechanical engineers and chemical engineers, but I'm looking at it all. Everything I see is like, I see stress strain curves and, you know, learn about all these problems. And I'm just thinking running shoes the whole time. But once I start learning about those things, it like blew my mind, started thinking like with every single material that any sort of mechanical engineer works with, you know, whether it's like a steel or if it's, you know, some sort of polymer, you characterize the material properties of it to understand its, you know, stiffness, its resilience, its, you know, all of these different characteristics. And it's like, we don't know any of those about running shoes. All we know is that, oh, this is a new foam. This is, oh, well, what's new about it? Oh, it has more energy return. How much? More. It's not proven. There's no scientific proof for this, but we say it does. Oh, great. Okay. Or this is more responsive. Well, what does responsive mean? Like all of these, like, I mean, it's almost like the way shoes are described, and we, and most people, their interaction with shoes are in these little paragraph descriptions, whether it's in a running magazine or on the website of the shoe company, that are more like tasting notes for a wine than actual scientific description of what's going on with the shoe. So it's like, oh, it's more cushioned, more responsive, like all of these things that could have a million different mechanical explanations for what they are. So, but I don't even know how we got rambling on that, but yeah.
No, you're right. Yeah, there's a lot of ambiguity in some of the terms that are used in the marketing side of it.
Yeah,
you know, even exactly. Like you say, there is rigorous testing that is done to determine those features of the materials, but it gets completely filtered out into some mm-hmm. very simple little interpretation that's very qualitative in nature by the time it gets pushed out. And, you know, I don't necessarily fault them for it. That's a marketing side. The audience, majority of audience, people may not even know how to interpret a number that they're given or want to work with it. They might just rather have a green light, yellow light, red light, and be happy with that. But it is interesting to see what happens to the data that is generated.
Yeah. So I guess that kind of segues into, you know, we're going to talk about this editorial that we published in BJSM, British Journal of Sports Medicine. This was published last year, and it was actually submitted about a year and a half ago.
Really?
2017. It took a while to get it. Long story there on getting it published. Yeah. I'm glad it came out in the form that it did, because when I originally wrote it, it was over twice the length, and it was much more scientific. There was a lot more explanations, but the editor really banged on us to condense it and trim it down. And I think at the end of the day, it was good because more people read it. And I think the point came through. It was just very concise. But anyways, it's centered on this new racing shoe, the Nike Vaporfly.
Let me just jump in with the title for the audience as well. So again, lead author is Jeff Burns, and the title of the paper is It the Shoes? A Simple Proposal for Regulating Footwear in Road Running, British Journal of Sports Medicine, April 2020. All right, take it away, Jeff.
Yeah, so the subject of the piece is that shoe, the Nike Vaporfly. So for your listeners, I'll just give them a history and a brief overview of the shoe. I'm sure a lot of them know about it, but just so we can all be on the same page. This shoe came out in 2017, and it was a new racing shoe from Nike. And it, at the time that it was released, it came out with, it was in conjunction with Eliud Kipchoge's first attempt at running a marathon distance in under 2 hours. And when they released it at the time of his event, and at the same time that it was released, it came a study they had in the development lead up, they'd commissioned a study from University of Colorado, Roger Crom's locomotion lab there, which is, you know, one of the, you know, if not, you know, the footwear biomechanics research lab, one of the eminent ones. They do a lot of the great, great research that we know on energy cost in relation to all sorts of things running, but also, you know, especially shoes. So this was, you know, the best lab to do it. And Roger also has, you know, some associations with Nike. And so they came in and went to Colorado and did this, and they did an absolutely beautiful study that definitively showed that this shoe reduce the cost of running as compared to other racing shoes. And so the cost of running, that's how much oxygen it costs to run at a certain speed. And it was, what they found was 4% as compared to kind of the other contemporary racing shoes. And that's, then they actually, Nike took the result of that study and used it in the name of the shoe, the Nike Vaporfly 4%. So anyways, this all comes out in 2017, and then right away you start seeing big chasms open up at the elite level of professional marathoners, of ones in this shoe and not. We start to see times getting a couple minutes faster than what we would expect. And it just ignites this whole debate on what the role of shoes are in sport, and whether we should regulate, how we should regulate. All this starts happening, and this is in 2017. So to talk about, we should then, I guess, moving forward, I'll give a short little overview of the science of running shoes and why the Nike Vaporfly was so much better than other shoes. So with shoes, you know, for the longest time, they were, they're made of a foam, ethylene vinyl acetate, EVA. So that's the foam that's in 90% of your running shoes, 95%. And prior to, say, you know, definitely through the 90 up until early 2000s, that was what is every single shoe. It was an EVA-based shoe. So EVA is great because it's light and cheap to manufacture. And it's not so great, though, at energy return. So that's one of these material properties that we talk about, is resilience of a material. That's when you put it under compression, how much it responds back. And EVA is pretty inefficient. It returns, you know, on the order of about 60, 65% of the energy under compression back. So again, through, I think maybe the 60s, the late 60s was the first time EVA had started being used in shoes. But so for decades, this was the material that was in shoes. And the optimality equation for shoes became, add a little bit of cushioning, enough to, you know, basically soften the blow on the pavement, a little bit of cushioning, but make it as light as possible. So make the optimality equation was minimize weight, because that's one of the things that, you know, increases the cost of running is as we add weight to our shoes, it gets obviously cost more and more to run, energetically speaking. So anyways, for a long time, decades, it was just a little bit of cushion, lightest weight possible. In, I think it was 2010, somewhere around there, 2011, early or mid 2000s, Adidas partnered with chemical firm BASF, and they came out with, you know, their name was Boost Foam. And this was kind of the first shakeup that we've had in a long time in foams and shoes. And this was not EVA, ethylene vinyl acetate, it was thermoplastic polyurethane, TPU. And so that is, as a foam, it's been used as a plastic for a long time, like a rigid plastic, but BASF came up with a way to blow it out into these little foam pellets. And the result was something that had a little bit more energy return. It was on the order of 75%. So it was, you know, more than EVA. And for anybody, I remember back when it first came out and stepping into my first pair of Boost shoes, even though that's a pretty small amount, stepping into them, be like, whoa, this does, it's a different sensation on your feet, and it's noticeable. But the trick was, it was denser than EVA, so it was heavier. So it was better energy return, but heavier. So it didn't really move the ball forward necessarily. It almost kind of, it was basically a sidestep. So you know, cost more to carry, but you also get a little back with each step. So it was still, the balance was hanging around. In 2015, and this is the thing that, you know, really afforded the development of the Vaporfly, there was Nike started working with a foam, and they actually weren't the first shoe company to use it. But they started working with this foam called PEBA, polyether block amide. And this is another copolymer that's different than EVA and different than TPU. And this one, I have to double check on this, but I think it was used as, like, again, this is one that's used commonly as a very, very rigid plastic. So it's actually used, whereas a lot of like shoe components, like sometimes like sprinting spikes, used carbon fiber. They replaced it with this material as a plastic, because it's a very rigid plastic that's very resilient, snaps back, and it's used in ski boots as well as a plastic. So anyways, a French chemical company blew it out into a foam. Arkema, I think, is the name of the chemical company. So anyways, this foam, it's under their proprietary name, it's PBAX. So this, once they blew this, you know, this rigid plastic out into a foam, found a way to do that, this foam, now, you know, if we think of EVA as 60-65% energy return, Boost 75%, the Colorado lab, and they tested all three of these, this was 87%. So now we're approaching perfect elasticity there. So not only is it 87%, like, so now you have way more energy return than these other. The kicker on it is that it's less dense than EVA, so it's even lighter. So it gives you back more energy, and it's lighter. So you get more, and it costs less to carry. So it's like, you know, having your cake and eating it too, veritably. So then this allowed us to just blow up the optimality equations for footwear and totally rethink how you make a shoe. And that's, you know, enter the Vaporfly there. So you have this huge, you know, this material that's very soft and squishy, but returns a lot of the energy. So they started, you know, playing around with this. And one of the things that, you know, again, with the foam, as soon as you look at this foam, it's like a marshmallow, where it's very, very squishy. It's compliant is the word we would say. It deforms a lot under the load, and then, you know, springs back. So it's very squishy. So another thing, you know, that they did is, now that they have this big squishy block of foam that's very resilient and bounces back, in order to stabilize that, put a carbon fiber plate through it. So that's where the Vaporfly took form, is this big block of squishy foam that has this curved carbon fiber plate. And then the geometry of that plate is also thought, you know, there are some hypotheses that could be beneficial as well, as, you know, being different than just a straight plate through it. But that geometry of that plate is only possible because of how much foam you have there. And again, your listener, they're listening to this, but you can think of it as the plate is almost like, you know, very mild S shape in that it's up at the heel and then it curves down and scoops down underneath the metatarsal joint. So the idea there is, you know, some of the research that they suggested on it was that it would reduce the work rate at the ankle, that the curvature there. But I think, you know, just putting the shoes on, and especially with that foam, it's, you know, I think really kind of the magic there is that it's like you capture that elasticity of the shoe, and then you use that plate to really stiffen up what would otherwise be almost like an unstable squishiness. technical mechanical term there.
So Jeff, just going to jump in quick and ask. So yeah. the with the changes you're talking about in terms of the energy return and such, is this something that the average recreational runner would be able to notice and take advantage of? Or are we really talking about things that, you know, are more for your sub-elite to elite level runners where we're really pushing that upper threshold?
Yeah. So I would say yes. The studies that have been done, so that there are three really nice studies that essentially repeated themselves. So there's the Colorado study was the first one, and then BYU and Grand Valley State University both did replication studies, and all of these have been done at paces. I think the Colorado study was 12, 14, 16, and 18 kilometers an hour, which is essentially 8 minute mile pace down to 527 mile pace. So about 8 minute pace down to 530 pace, and saw that it was a very consistent benefit across that, the running economy. I'll say, I guess two things to that point in terms of a recreational or, you know, just somebody out on the roads noticing a difference. I will say, I think you would be hard pressed to find any person who would step in a pair of those shoes and not think that it feels totally different than anything they've ever put on their feet. That is definitive. The other really interesting thing is I don't necessarily think the shoes are going to be, you know, quote unquote comfortable for everybody. Even elite runners, I think there's a large number of people who put them on and think like, oh, this feels kind of weird, especially, I mean, they feel very strange walking around in because of that stiff plate. But I think what the shoe demonstrated, and this was, I mean, it's something I've noticed in myself over the years, but I think is it's a fallacy that persists through a lot of running shoes, is this idea that like we definitively know what shoe is best based on what is most comfortable. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that there's truth to that, especially in terms of like what works well for logging a lot of miles. But in terms of what is best for performance, I think that there is probably going to be a mismatch between what is best for performance and what maybe feels most comfortable on your foot. And this shoe demonstrated that like regardless of what you think about it, it's good for you in terms of running fast. So getting back to like the benefit that we'd see at lower speeds, it's really interesting is Roger Crom's lab also shortly after this did a modeling exercise to kind of extrapolate what they would expect the cost of, you know, what would a benefit in running economy translate to a benefit in running speed? So if you have a 4% improvement in your running economy, what does that translate to speed? And this was led by Shalaya Kipp, who's master's student there at the time, where I think she's doing physiology in British Columbia now. But it was this really cool modeling study that took into account air resistance as well as the nonlinear increase in oxygen uptake as you go across speeds. And what they demonstrated was that as you get faster and faster and faster, the running economy benefit becomes less and less and less for speed. So at elite marathon speeds, somebody running 205 for a marathon, that 4% improvement in running economy is probably about a 2% improvement in performance, 2% mm-hmm. improvement in running speed. But at around, I can't remember what the crossover point was, but for somebody running in the 3+ hour marathon range, 4-hour marathon range, It's 1-to-1, and then slower than that, the running economy benefit actually yields an even greater increase in performance. Now, what we don't know with that shoe is how at, you know, below that 8-minute mile pace or something like that, how that, you know, benefit starts to change. But another cool thing that, you know, one of the beautiful pieces to this story that came out was the New York Times actually did two really cool big data analyses. And they're really, really nicely, you know, well analyzed data sets from enormous spectrum of marathon performances. So while, you know, we had a couple of very controlled laboratory studies, these data scientists at the Times went and took, you know, tens of thousands of marathon performances where they had, from Strava data, they had people in different shoes and then them switching to the Vaporfly. And they demonstrated that, you know, there was a pretty much a 4% performance shift in this shoe, but it was stratified so that the slower runners over those like 4+ hour marathoners were running 5+% faster in it. And then the guys under 220 were right around 3%. So yes, long answer, pretty much everybody's probably going to see a benefit from the shoe. And it comes from, I mean, it's one of those things where when the shoe first came out and I first heard about the foam that they were using, this maybe we'll get back on track to the editorial here. But the thing that jumped out to me was when I heard about that foam, and it was actually, wasn't even in the, it was in a wired piece, where it described the PBAX foam and kind of that it was lighter than EVA and returned X% more energy. And when I saw that, I was like, whoa, like hold the phone. I've never heard of this foam before. Like, what the heck is this? That's the game changer. Cause for a long time it was, again, like I said, that's the interface between our foot and the ground. But what I guess really frustrated me in the ensuing discussion around that shoe was all of the attention was and discussion was given to the carbon fiber plate in the shoe. And I think the plate is necessary for the benefit of the shoe. But it is not, you know, if you put a carbon fiber plate in an EVA shoe, it might be a little bit better, but we have data to suggest, laboratory data to suggest that it won't be better, or maybe be only, you know, maybe 1% better for some people, not nearly the magnitude of difference that we see in this. So it's not, and that's, again, like frustrated me hearing the ensuing conversation around this, because started hearing people talking about, you know, banning plates and shoes and carbon fiber shoes ruining running. And like, this is not what's going on here. It's much more complex. I mean, in some ways it's more complex than this, but if you want to reduce it to something, it's like, at least focus on the thing that is affording this benefit, which is largely that foam. And so, I mean, we've seen that with the shoe company's response to this. The first wave of response from all the different shoe companies was just coming out with carbon fiber plates in their shoes, which is again not well directed efforts. But so anyways, I'm seeing all this going on, and there's discussion on regulating, how to regulate, should we regulate, and that's kind of where I landed. It was like, okay, there's a lot of noise going on here, and I think if we you know, where we landed, and I think, and I was very torn myself, because I'm somebody who, I was very 50-50 on whether or not I think we should regulate shoes. But the thing that I really did not want to happen was bad regulation, or misguided regulation on shoes. I thought that would be not good, or overly complicated regulation. So this whole debate around the shoes is very analogous, very similar to what we saw in swimming in 2008, 2009 with the tech suits.
Yep.
So for your listeners, if they don't remember that, we had these suits come out that were these full length, you know, body suits that were a different material, that were very buoyant, that kept the, you know, both kept the swimmers up, as well as we're very tight on their body. and they just, you know, drastically reduced the swim times, and they're an enormous performance benefit. And you just saw shredding the records, and it just became this big, a big controversy within swimming. It was like, took the Olympics by storm. But then they were essentially forced to regulate, not just because of, there was controversy at the top level of the sport and the professional side, but when it started to just kind of rot the sport at all different levels, that's when they really took action to regulate it, because you started to see, whether it's at the NCAA level or the youth level, or then people doing masters competitions and club competitions, became this enormous have and have not, just this complicating thing that they were forced to regulate on the suits. So what they did to regulate the suits, I didn't want to see happen in running, where to now suits have to be sent to a lab, FINA, which is the Federation International, something French acronym for the International Body of Swimming. They get tested on several mechanical properties, material properties. They have a buoyancy test, a permeability test. There's a geometry test of stipulating how much body area can be covered. Something else with the textile properties, I can't remember. But so they test all these things about the suits and say, yes or no, you can use it. And I thought, like, we cannot do that with running. We can't have something where they come up with a set of like mechanical parameters that we have to test shoes. We have to send them to a lab and get them okayed and send them back. I thought that would just be an operational nightmare for running, because one of the appeals of running is kind of the democracy of it, the universality of it. So I thought if we had this case where we had to send shoes to get approved and regulated, that not only is problematic in itself, but selecting what parameters, like what is an acceptable amount of energy return? How are we going to characterize this test? Like that I talked about in our last podcast, but I was doing, you know, test method development for a medical device company with like FDA compliance. I was thinking about this for running shoes. I'm like, man, if you didn't have a tight testing protocol, you could like, that it'd be so noisy, and it'd just be just a, it would be such a headache to try and come up with all this stuff. Thought like, what is the simplest way to have this regulation? That captures the spirit of it. So I thought was, why don't we just, if you just ignore, or not ignore, but just look at the shoe from a systemic level, from what it is, shoes are in effect springs, or maybe more technically speaking, they're spring damper systems. They're an extension of our body that we put on ourselves to have both, you know, dampening and energy return. So the dampening is the cushioning, the energy return, you know, is the spring-like function. So if we just look at them as that, is essentially this spring system on the bottom of our foot, our proposal in the editorial was, everything that's going on in that shoe, we have this foam, then we have this plate inside the shoe, and then we have this kind of thicker shoe in itself that, you know, is essentially extending the effective leg length of the runner with non-biological material. We have all of these things interacting that could be construing different amounts of performance benefit that we can't really disentangle. Just look at it all as a system and just govern that system. You know, what is the extent that you could have a shoe? So we said, just limit the thickness of the shoe, the maximum thickness of the shoe. That essentially, if you look at the shoe as a spring, that effectively limits the length of the spring. It creates a very general design constraint from which we can then work within. So that was the proposal. And so, you know, it gets back to this idea, being on the fence, should we regulate or should we not regulate? I think in this debate with the shoes, we have two broad questions, and that is, should we even regulate shoes or not, or should we let them self-regulate? Maybe that's something we can talk about later. But then the second question is, if we say yes to the first one, if we do want to limit the extent to which footwear can affect performance, how do we regulate? And I don't think we can really have a good debate on that first question without a really good answer to that second one. Because if we have a bad regulation or a noisy regulation, like a very, you know, poorly constructed regulation, then the debate just becomes noisy. So I thought, let's lay down just a good simple regulatory framework, and then we can worry about whether we peel it back later or modify it later or something. But yeah,
that was a great summary and kind of walkthrough about the logic behind it and how you developed the editorial to start with. So we've got time for one more question for you. So I've got to ask. The editorial has been out now for a couple of months at least, and I'm sure it was even ahead of print for available for a little while. What sort of response have you got from it? What have people been? Have you heard back from anybody? Any thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, it came out in, you know, it was released online in October of 2018, and I mean, the funny thing is it was just going back and forth with reviewers and the editor so much. And finally we got it in like a nice finalized form. And it was in the lead up to Eliud Kipchoge's 159 stunt that was done in October. And I remember sending a message to the editor like, hey, he's going to run this and this is going to reignite this debate. Like, we need to get this out as soon as we can because it's going to be timely. And then as soon as Kipchoge did that, at the same time, Bridget Koskay smashed Paula Radcliffe's world record, which has been standing. And then the editorial like dropped that week. And it was just the perfect timing of everything and just really got the discussion going. So had a lot of feedback. First, there was, I would say, overwhelmingly a lot of really positive feedback from both the running community as well as a lot of sports scientists, because I think it just makes it, I mean, the motivation of it was not just from a biomechanics standpoint, because it's not just a biomechanics question. There really is a sociological element to this, is both the operation side, is how do you enforce this rule? How do you put it in? Like, where does it fit in how the sport functions, but also kind of, you know, being guided by, you know, a logical design constraint for the engineering side of it. So I think there's a lot of positive feedback. Like, yes, that makes sense. Like, just limit the extent of the shoe. There was definitely some pushback within the hardcore biomechanics world, or at least like a little bit more discussion there. There were some responses Ned Fredericks, who's the editor of Footwear Science, put back a response to it. And Wouter Hooschkamer, who did the Colorado study, also published a response. And one of the critiques that frustrated me a lot that I kept hearing was that they're like, well, we have no evidence to suggest that midsole thickness is beneficial. And to that, I would say we never made that claim. And I would hope you would not have read that and thought that I was, you know, that we made the claim that shoe thickness is necessarily beneficial. No, like, we never made that claim, and I certainly would not ever suggest that. And I mean, I'm sure anybody who's, you know, with any familiarity with shoes would of course know that. The idea is that not that midsole, and this is what I think makes it a really good regulation, is that midsole thickness is not a sufficient condition for a beneficial shoe, but I suspect it's a necessary condition, and that makes it a good regulatory tool. That is, a thick shoe is not going to be beneficial, but a beneficial shoe, or at least one that's more beneficial than conventional shoes, is likely going to need to be thick. Because what happens is, now that we have these materials that are, you know, essentially function better than the human body does in terms of recycling energy, the more and more of those more beneficial non-biological materials that we add to the body, the more space that we have, the more space we have in which to optimize the architecture. So that idea that it is not a sufficient condition, but it is a necessary condition. So I think that's what I would say is, like, yes, of course we have no evidence to suggest that, because midsole thickness is not in itself beneficial, but benefit likely needs thickness. Or at least the benefit to which we've seen with the Vaporfly. You're not going to make a shoe that is 4% more beneficial, you know, with a 20 millimeter thick shoe, which is what conventional racing shoes were. So anyways, that's what I would say to that end. So that was kind of some of the early feedback. And then I would say the ultimate piece of feedback came in January of 2020 at the end, when the IAAF, or now World Athletics as they renamed, announced their plans to regulate shoes. And they set a limit of 40 millimeters on the shoe, which was, I guess we have time, I can add my own thoughts on their overall regulatory strategy. They set the limit of 40 millimeters, which I was at first happy to see, because I thought that if it was my personal opinion, I would want it to be tighter than that. Like I would like it to be what racing shoes used to be, which is 20, 25 millimeters. But 40, about the newest generation of the Nike Vaporfly for your listeners was, we had ones in our lab that we cut up that were men's size 10.5, and those were about 38 millimeters thick, which is, again, think about that. That's substantially thicker. That's thicker than, I think, even Hoka, which everybody knows of Hoka as the maximalist shoe. The Vaporfly, for your listeners to know, the Vaporfly is thicker than any Hoka shoe. It's very, very, it's the first thing you notice when you pick it up is like, whoa, that is a big shoe. But it's, the crazy thing is, because that foam is so light, it's so less dense than EVA. It's so light, with massive block that is super light. Anyways, so I thought 40 millimeters, that's great, because that essentially encompasses all shoes that are on the market now, because the biggest sizes of the Vaporfly are probably right around that. But one of the things that I had actually put in a very early version of the editorial that we nixed was like this idea that if you're going to regulate thickness, you need to have, it needs to be linearly scaled to size, because that's how you manufacture shoes. Just again, gets back to like, I think that there's certainly an element of logic to that. Like a women's size 6 shoe is not going to be the same geometry as a men's size 14. But again, having worked in a running shoe store and experience across this run of sizes, as you go up size, it gets, millimeter by millimeter thicker and thicker. So I thought one of the things that they would need, if you're going to codify this into rules, to make a technical rule, you need to have some sort of like size scaled thickness. You could standardize it and say 40 millimeters at men's size 10, whatever. And so the IAAF did that. They said measured at, I think it's an EU 42, which is a men's 8.5, is 40 millimeters. But they didn't make it size dependent. They gave some nonsense BS like flowery language of like, oh, sizes larger and smaller sizes will be marginally thicker and less thick than that based on that. But that's not true. Like you get bigger and bigger, and they get, so anyways, 40 millimeters for men's size 8.5 is very thick. And without a sliding scale, you have all sorts of play for that. And what you could make a custom shoe that is, a 10 that is way thicker than that. So anyways, that was problematic on itself, but I think it's a good step forward. But they also added a bunch of rules in there, a couple clauses about carbon fiber plate construction, which I'm not a fan of. I think that is, it's unnecessary if you have a tight enough thickness regulation, because this gets back to the other motivation behind the regulation strategy was, if you make a reasonably conservative thickness constraint, like my thought was like, put whatever you want in there. If you want to put a carbon fiber plate in, like if that's the best way to make a shoe, great. It's a nice compromise between innovation and limitation. That's like, here's the space in which we're working with. If it's 30 millimeters or 40 millimeters, just optimize within that. And then eventually maybe we could start personalizing that optimization. But my thought was like, if you have enough of a constraint, you don't need any rules on what type of things are in there, because again, the thinner and thinner that shoe is, the geometry of any sort of plate or other element that you add that we can't even imagine, doesn't really matter. But anyways, so that thickness constraint that they put in is like large enough. They added some rules. So it was a little bit, they went with the thickness idea, but also added some to it. And I think we haven't heard the last of this story. That's for sure. And it really, it's really a very much, I would say, when your listeners are listening to this, I think it's very much, we're going to be leading into probably the next chapter of it, because right when this regulation dropped, Nike launched a new iteration of the shoe, which is even more complex, which I think is, my hope is that the IAAF will, or the World Athletics will revisit and tighten up the regulation. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll even loosen up. I don't know. But I think, again, it was the first chapter in the saga of shoes.
Well, it's pretty cool to be able to have your editorial be, you know, at that early stage of the process, and in some way, even you know, who knows? It's hard to say what role it played in shaping it or developing it, but that's pretty cool stuff. And I think it's something a lot of people strive for at some point in their career, to potentially influence policy, and to be able to do that or contribute to that so early in yours. That's, you know, kudos to you. It's always great chatting with you, Jeff. You've got a wealth of information and background, and you're never at a loss for a good story. So it's great.
Thanks for letting me ramble for a while. I hope your listeners aren't asleep, or you know.
I'm sure they're not. I mean, you've got some really good nuggets and tidbits. So again, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time today to be part of it.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brian, Jeremy.
Yeah, I have a feeling we'll be watching your work for many years to come, and hopefully at some point you'll still remember us when, and maybe jump back as another guest.
Oh, I'm sure we will continue to cross paths. I hope we continue to cross paths.
That'd be great. I look forward to it. Well, that brings us to the end of today's podcast. On behalf of my co-host, Jeremy Stoker, we'd like to thank you for tuning in. And as a reminder, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Registration for the 2020 Mountainland Running Summit is open, with full details for the live online event at summit.mlrehab.com. As always, you can find more information on all the running medicine resources offered by Mountainland Physical Therapy at mlrehab.com/run. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Exercises that are safe and appropriate for some people may not be for you. No treatment program should be undertaken without first consulting your physical therapist or physician. The contents of this podcast is protected under United States copyright laws and may not be reproduced, redistributed, transmitted, displayed, published, or broadcast without prior written permission of Mountainland Physical Therapy.